Well, good morning. It's a clear sign of success when you have to open the back of the hearing room and add additional chairs. So thank you all for being here. Committee of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee for the United States Senate will come to order. I would like to welcome all those who have joined us this morning on a beautiful Cordova morning. I would like to start by thanking the community of Cordova for hosting us today. Mayor, it's always good to be back in your town. I know that I am not supposed to pick favorites among communities, but I think the folks here in Cordova know that I have a very, very special place in my heart for this community and for its people and for its fish. Tonight is always a fun evening where we recognize the value, the benefit, and really all the good that comes to a community when you have good, strong resources such as our Copper River salmon. So good reason to celebrate. And that reason to celebrate actually allowed us to select Cordova as the site or a field hearing for the Energy Committee. When Mayor Coughlin appeared before the committee in Washington, D.C. earlier this year, and we were speaking about infrastructure, and the discussion was pretty broad-ranging, and here we have the mayor of Cordova speaking about what a community like Cordova, that is islanded in the sense of not being part of any infrastructure grid. His testimony was so compelling, and how he described the attributes of this beautiful fishing community sparked others on the committee to say, maybe we should have a field hearing there. I think it might have actually been suggested initially by Senator Franken, and Senator Cantwell and I looked at one another and said, why not? Why not? And so the opportunity to be here in person to see the integrated energy system that has helped move this community off of diesel generation is why we're here this morning. Not just to focus, though, on Cordova, but what it is that has been done in Alaska, working with the benefits of our national labs and working with those here in the state to really be pioneering and innovating in the area of energy. So I'm pleased to be able to bring to Cordova my friend and my ranking member on the committee, Senator Cantwell. This is her second visit to the state now in the past 18 months. We had an opportunity to go to Bethel not too many months ago with Secretary Moniz and several other colleagues, looking at a different aspect of energy, but the focus on technology innovation is something that we share great interest in. We started off this energy trip by stopping in Seattle yesterday, and Senator Cantwell hosted as we toured the Bullitt Center. This is the world's greenest building. And when you think about innovation in building technologies and how so much can be done in a manner that you barely even notice it, looking at what the Bullitt Center has done is just incredibly inspirational. We also had an opportunity to visit McKinster, where we talked about workforce training, cybersecurity efforts, and just the collaborative efforts that go on with cybersecurity, efficiency through integrated systems, as we look at smart buildings and how we can better monitor. And then we kind of capped off the morning with a discussion with Bill Gates about the future of energy in innovation. So it was a pretty inspirational morning, and I really thank Senator Cantwell for putting that together. But it's a great opportunity, I think, then to take those those discussions and what we learned yesterday about that energy for the future, and then bring it back home on the ground. What does it mean, particularly to high-cost energy states like Alaska, but where we have extraordinary opportunity within our renewables, where we have incredible innovation that is going on in small ways, in very discreet ways that perhaps don't make the front page of anybody's newspaper except perhaps the Cordova Times, but how we can really help build that out, because I think we recognize that innovation is almost a necessity here in Alaska. Self-reliance, ingenuity, these are hallmarks of the people. And when we think about how our communities are so isolated, our energy infrastructure in this state is effectively the interconnected grid that runs from the Kenai Peninsula up to Fairbanks, but so many of our communities are isolated by our geography, our distance, and have to rely on local generation to supply the power. And so many of these communities, you've got situations where you've got the fuel barge that comes in once, twice a year. Mira, in your in many of AVEX region, that's your reality. And so how you deal with that in cold, remote environments is very, very difficult. So recognizing that so many of our isolated communities have partnered with the state and the federal government to integrate renewable resources into their microgrids in an effort to provide greater sustainability and, of course, greater affordability is so important. So we're going to hear from a great panel this morning. Mayor Copeland will talk to us about what it is that we have seen here in Cordova and how that level of innovation has made a difference, but also, again, beyond just this community. We're also welcomed this morning to have Gwen Holdman, who is the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and some of the innovative ideas that we have seen coming out of ACEP is really, again, very inspirational. Mira Kohler, who is well known here in Cordova and around the state, is the chief executive officer of AVEC, the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. It's not too often that you have a Senate Energy Committee hearing where you have witnesses who have a six-pack of beer in front of them. Jeff Larson, who's the CEO and co-founder of Alaska Brewing Company, will provide, I think, a very important lesson to us in terms of the types of innovation that we can see that really do help our small businesses become more than small businesses. And so the leadership that they have embraced down in Juneau is really quite remarkable. And Dr. Abram Ellis, our out-of-town or out-of-state visitor today, we welcome you. Dr. Ellis is the principal technical staff for the Sandia National Laboratory, whose work focuses on renewable integration in remote areas. So, again, when we think about the innovation and how innovation is best facilitated when you've got collaboration at different levels, whether it's the local, the state, the tribal, the federal, this is how we can be helpful at the federal level to try to help build out those frameworks. So we have a couple things going on in Washington that perhaps you haven't heard about because the Washington news has been preoccupied by other things. On Thursday morning, there was a very important hearing in Washington, and it was not the Senate Intelligence Committee. It was our Energy Committee that was not talking about the former director of the FBI, but we were talking about innovation in energy and how it drives down costs. And I thought it was a great, exciting, dynamic hearing. And I think more people should have plugged into that one for really direction and inspiration in terms of what can be had to help advance this country. Senator Cantwell and I continue to work on our energy bill that we've been working on now for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years. We have a partnership in energy that I think is recognized in Washington as being good, constructive, enduring, and persistent, and we will persist with our efforts to get energy updates that will help our community, our country for the long haul. So, Dr. Ellis, I appreciate you being here, all of the members of our panel being here. I want to recognize those here at the Cordova Center that have helped just facilitate this hearing this morning, Kathy Sherman, Mimi Briggs, and Jason Gabrielson, as well as the Energy Committee staffs that have helped to facilitate it. So Senator Cantwell, I can't thank you enough for being here. I appreciate not only your engagement on this issue here this morning, but the bigger aspects of energy policy that together we're working to help advance. So welcome. The floor is yours before we turn it over to our panel of distinguished witnesses.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you so much for this invitation to come to Cordova. I have to be honest, when we had our hearing in Washington, D.C., and the mayor promised Copper River salmon, yes, my ears peaked up. I noticed last night when we got in, we almost had to speak in code to get it on the menu. So I felt like when we looked, told the waitress and kind of looked over towards the mayor, she was like, oh yes, it is on the menu. Okay. So thank you, Mayor, for delivering and for the hospitality. I've mentioned to several people, yes, Cordova is well known in the Puget Sound region, and we appreciate the relationship between our fishing industry and so many aspects. I'm sure Mr. Larson is going to tell me about how he buys hops from the Yakima Valley and many, many other things. So our states are tied together, and they have been historically, and we continue to work together on that. So I look very much forward to listening to the panelists and hearing about these issues this morning. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for coming to Seattle yesterday and the tour of the facilities that that we did, and to constantly think of ways in which the next steps in energy system delivery improvements need to be made so that we can continue to drive down costs to our consumers and make our businesses competitive. I would have to say one of the highlights of my day yesterday was watching your senator show a picture to Bill Gates of how to grow lettuce in a small container in her office that is being done by so many villagers all across Alaska in the school system. And I just thought that was so great because we just heard this global picture about energy, and I think she was doing a fantastic job of bringing it right back down to today. Like what we're able to deliver today really matters to the people of Alaska. So I thought you would have been proud of her, and proud of her constantly focusing in on these issues, just as you should be as it relates to this Energy Modernization Act that we've been working on that she mentioned we were successful at getting out of the Senate. And didn't quite get the full attention of our House colleagues, and we are now trying to get their full attention as they have a little more time. But let me assure you, there is no deterrence here when it comes to Senator Murkowski's dedication to this issue. And she and I, with her taking the lead, marched across the Capitol one night at like 10 o'clock at night, sussing out staff and House members trying to get their attention. So she will go the extra mile. So I thank her for that. And I thank all of our witnesses today for their contribution to this discussion. Today's topic about microgrids and hybrid energy systems is really, really important. And the one thing I hope that Alaskans take away from this hearing is how important it is that you continue to pioneer in this area. There are so many important things to discuss, but clearly the concept of necessity is the mother of invention comes to mind here, that Alaskans are dealing with this issue of anywhere from 50 cent per kilowatt to a $1.50 kilowatt hour in rural villages, so 5 to 15 times the average of what a consumer is paying in the lower 48, really does drive the level of discussion and attention to detail here on this issue. So by making sure that Alaskans continue to look at ways to diversify off of the very vulnerable fluctuations in oil prices is something I think we're going to hear about, and reliable hybrid energy systems with renewable microgrids coupled with the diesel and renewable sources. I can't wait to hear, you know, how all of these things, hydro, wind, geothermal, are working together to help Alaskans maximize and create opportunities. So I know that Alaskans are a global leader not only in self-reliance but also in microgrid technology. And this is something that would have huge applications all around the globe. And the fact that you're continuing to pioneer here, you are already the home to 200 microgrids, 70 of which are powered by renewable sources, including that hydropower, biomass, geothermal, wind, and solar. That's 12% of the world's renewable hybrid microgrid systems are right here in Alaska. So you really are pioneering something that will pay dividends for all of us in the future. Smarter, cheaper controls, integration of technologies, microgrid solutions, not just for remote communities, but just think about them for hospitals, for schools, for our challenges as we look at reliability. And the chair mentioned this issue a little bit of cybersecurity. We definitely had a discussion yesterday about that, about what we need to do to upgrade the entire grid system and critical infrastructure like pipelines from the potential of cybersecurity attacks. This isn't like something that's, you know, might happen tomorrow. This is something that's happening every single day, and our utilities and others are fighting against that. So when you think about it, the application of microgrids and the technology of microgrids is another example of how you sustain, if those kinds of attacks might happen, the microgrids can build some insulation and some security layers into the system. So I just encourage you to continue to pioneer in this technology. Regional energy solutions should be a priority for our nation, and the reason that is so clear to me here in Alaska today is because these solutions help build a robust system that take advantage of our labs, and I'm so glad our labs are here today, academia, and the private sector. These are the people who are going to take the ethereal and put them into real life action, and we need to continue to make progress on them. So I've been a strong proponent of performance metrics for microgrids and investing in matching federal dollars to help increase the grid resilience. So we were proud to work together, as my colleague said, on the energy bill to tailor the needs to places like Cordova, but also places like Anchorage and Seattle, so that the interconnectedness is there. But we are also exposed to just natural disasters. Forget cybersecurity for a minute. Natural disasters can happen, and the notion that we need to have a strategy, I think both Alaska and Washington get this very clearly about how the grid could be disrupted and what we would need to do to set up a system to help build more resiliency for our state. So I look forward to hearing from all the witnesses here and to hear the input and suggestions as we continue to deal with this issue at our national level. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention, I don't get to stay for this big celebration tonight, but maybe in the future I could come back. But certainly support the efforts of science in the marine area that is going on here in Cordova, as well as a member of the Commerce Committee and the upcoming reauthorization of Magnuson-Stevenson. It's very important that we continue to have great science in our fisheries as well, and look forward to working with the community on those issues. But we're so excited to hear from our witnesses today. Again, Mayor, thank you for delivering. And I see that might also be a parting gift that I will definitely share. There is two. I thought there was only one. I thought we were going to have to fight over this. Okay, I'm happy now. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Cantwell. You know, it's always about the fish. We all come out of the fish. But just thank you. Thank you for being here and for your leadership on this. And the recognition. I think it's important for those who are attending the hearing this morning and those who will later read the record to understand how much Alaska is pioneering. When you repeated the statistic, 12% of the hybrid microgrids in the world are here in our state. And sometimes I think we don't think that we're being that innovative or pioneering. We just figure things out, and sometimes we say, gosh, we just did that with a little duct tape and made it happen. But I think what we need to be reminded is that others are looking, they're watching, they're trying to learn from us, and that hopefully is very empowering to each of you. It certainly is to me. Mayor Koppen, we're going to ask you to lead off the panel. Mayor Clay Koppen of the City of Cordova. He will be followed by, again, Dr. Abram Ellis, who is the Principal Technical Staff at Sandia National Laboratory, Ms. Gwen Holdman, who is the Director for Alaska Center for Energy and Power, Mira Kohler, Chief Executive Officer for Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, Mr. Jeff Larson, CEO and co-founder of Alaska Brewing Company. And for those who are not familiar with how a Senate hearing is conducted, we ask each of our witnesses to provide their oral testimony, trying to limit it to about 5 minutes or so. Your full statement will be included as part of the record. When each of you have concluded your remarks, Senator Cantwell and I will begin a series of questions going back and forth. We will allow for the record to be extended or kept open so that if you would like to supplement or if we have additional questions, it does become part of the full committee record. So even though we're not conducting this in Washington, D.C., it is being recorded and transcribed as part of the full committee record for the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. So, Mayor, thank you for having us in your beautiful community, and thank you for your leadership in so many different areas.
Thank you, Senator Murkowski and Ranking Member Cantwell. It's good to have you here this morning. As Senator Murkowski mentioned, I'm Clay Koppen, Mayor of Cordova, Alaska, and CEO of Cordova Electric Cooperative. We welcome you to the City of Cordova and the ancestral homeland of the Native Village of Iyak. We're so pleased to engage in this exciting conversation. Cordova really is an ideal location for having this discussion about street smart innovation, resilient microgrids, and hybrid energy systems that characterize many of our more fortunate Alaskan utilities and the communities they serve. We really do excel at innovating, at marshaling lean resources, and integrating unlikely and seemingly incompatible technologies into our energy systems, often improving the products and the applications in the process. My primary focus this morning is going to be on the innovation piece, kind of with a backdrop or context of CEC's hybrid microgrid system. So how can we accelerate innovation and improve the development and operation of microgrids and hybrid energy systems? I think it revolves around three opportunities. One, we need to increase the prominence and the participation of the innovators on the low end. And please carry that message back to Bill Gates. I've read through all their materials and they're kind of missing the little guys. Mm-hmm. Continue to fund the national programs and the departments in our national laboratories and their important roles. And bring industry and government closer to the problem, like you're doing today, actually, before the solutions are developed, so that we as the end users and innovators can weigh in and be a part of that process as it's happening. 2 weeks ago, CEC and Mira Kohler co-hosted the Canadian Off-Grid Utility Association's biennial meeting right here in Cordova. Gwen Holdman also attended that event, as did an engineer from Greenland's utility, Nukissirfeet. And on Gwen's recommendation to the U.S. State Department, I was able to travel to Greenland last October and share some of the best practices that we've developed right here in Cordova. And they're now operating one of their hydro projects at well above its rated capacity because we figured out how with our under 100% underground power lines to leverage our good power factor here in town to get more out of our equipment with the manufacturer's concurrence and warranty. So we shared that with them. Alex Hagmuller, one of the neighbors right down the street from me in Cordova, who was born and raised here, grew up working in local machine shops and commercial fishing before he decided to go back to Oregon State University and pursue his mechanical engineering degree. And while he was there, he joined his friend Max Ginsburg in founding Aqua Harmonics and designing a wave energy generator in their garage out of pocket, and ultimately won the Department of Energy's $1.4 million Wave Energy X Prize. Alex is a product of his environment, and we need to support and strengthen these rural ecosystems and their role in innovating, just as the Wright brothers did from their bicycle shop, and as Hewlett and Packard and Jobs and Wozniak did from their garages. So in 2004, we had a submarine cable that goes north out of town here to our Humpback Creek project that was damaged in a weather event. And we used a car battery and a handheld multimeter to pinpoint that fault in a 3.5 mile long cable to within 10 feet. And we repurposed and recycled wire reels and used local boats and divers and careful logistical planning to cut and splice and repair that cable and put it back in service, and it's still operating till today. Under $60,000, less than 3 months, and a conventional repair would have easily cost $1 million and taken over a year. Resources we just don't have. So how does this innovation happen, and what's the end result? The right people in the right place at the right time with the right partners. We're really fortunate that many of our staff at Cordova Electric were born and raised here in Cordova, went elsewhere to get their technical skills and their educations, and then they brought it home. And that's where our capacity and our leadership on the forefront of this energy transformation is derived from. That's our core strength, is our people and what they do and how they do it. So we need to build on that momentum and use the lessons learned to benefit communities and industries across the country more broadly. We at CEC continue our march towards a full smart grid capability with 100% local renewable sourcing of our local energy supplies. This will someday allow distributed generation, energy storage, home appliances, electric vehicles, businesses and industrial equipment and lighting to electronically and automatically communicate with our own high-capacity energy supply system. That's really what smart grid is going to look like. That's how we can allow renewable energy to be deployed when it's available, to charge those storage devices and then discharge and kind of go into hibernation when it's not available. So the whole system becomes flexible and interactive based on the technology platforms that are being developed. The National Renewable Energy Lab recently met with the Native Village of EAC, and I'm glad to see Daryl Olson, the tribal chairman here. And they came to Cordova, and after a quick dialogue with the Native Village of EAC, said, you know what, you are not a candidate for technical support. You are a candidate for best practices here on our part. And they came out here and spent 4 days picking our brains and trying to figure out what's the secret sauce that you have going here. And a lot of it just boils down to really working together within the community here as organizations to move the ball forward. So one of those two staff decided she wants to do her sabbatical here in Cordova, and I hope she can. And both of them looked around and said, this is really a candidate for a natural lab outpost. You just have the infrastructure and the human and organizational capacity to really contribute. So we need technology outposts like that in Alaska, where we can return at least as much benefit to the partners and the industries and the governments that we work with as we derive from it. Alaskans face such a challenging environment with such limited resources, similar to Washington, as you mentioned, in many ways, which is why we have to collaborate. It's why I sit on the ASEP's board of directors. It's why I work with Mira, with the Statewide Utility Managers Group, and join her in sitting on as many national organization board of trusteeships and places as we can to bring that technology back and learn how we can collaborate better. So the energy storage project that we're currently working on with the Alaska Center for Energy Power and Sandia National Labs is really exciting, and it's a perfect example of how we marry that high technology to that kind of street smart innovation and take us all to a better place. When Rob Royce, who is out in the audience here with ABB, talked to me a few months ago about maybe Cordova being a smart grid demonstration city for ABB, we got really excited. But we have to figure out how to make that happen. We have to give Rob the tools to be able to go back to his corporate leadership and say, hey, not only does Cordova have the capacity to pull something like this off, but you have the support at the state and federal level to stand behind this and make something cool happen and move us all forward. I know ABB will walk away a better company with better products and better applications than they came here with. But we just have that same challenge of showing them and getting them visibility to what we do and how we do it. So thank you for this opportunity to testify. I really encourage any questions you have to ask here at the end or through the questions for the record. And strongly encourage you to support the investments and partnerships in Alaska and Cordova and other organizations within the state, where we've already established a really good foundation from which we can build a bright future. Thank you.
Thank you, Clay. It's good to be in this technology outpost. I never really thought about it that way, but I guess that's where we are, Technology Outpost Cordova, Alaska. Dr. Ellis, tell us how the national labs fit in with so much of what is going on. I think you had a great segue there from the mayor.
Absolutely. Let me start by saying good morning and thank you, Chairman Murkowski and Ranking Member Cantwell, for the invitation to share my perspectives about this very important topic of microgrids and hybrid energy systems. I'd like to commend the committee for the location of choice. I'm looking forward to tasting the good salmon here. Haven't had a chance yet, but the reputation precedes you here, so that's awesome. Cordova certainly exemplifies, as the mayor says, the magnitude of the challenge that we have to deal with to meet the energy needs of remote communities, but it also exemplifies what is possible when the right stakeholders come together to work on a sustainable solution. As we learn more about Cordova's success story today, I think it's very important for all of us to remember there are many communities here in Alaska and across the world that struggle with meeting their energy needs every day. Today, what I'd like to do is convey three messages. The first one is that microgrids represents still a very complex technical challenge with significant unresolved technical questions that really merit additional research and development. Second, I'd like to say that microgrids have been and will continue to be a really effective incubator for new technologies that are useful for the grid. And third, that advancements in microgrids not only support the needs of these remote communities and island communities, but they are also an important ingredient to national energy resilience, and they're also drivers for grid modernization. Let me share with you a little bit of my own personal and professional experience with microgrids. I grew up in a small town in Panama, actually, isolated from the grid, with electricity evolved there in that town in much the same way as it imagined it here in Cordova. It started with a few diesel generators and stores and coffee processing plants. Eventually, we added a hydroelectric plant and a small distribution grid. The benefits were, as you can imagine, very broad and immediate. However, even though electricity was, you know, expensive and unreliable, it was very welcome in the community. It was very difficult. We struggled, actually, with maintaining the system, keeping it operational, and then planning for growth in the future. It's always a challenge. My first job, that's 25 years ago or so, promoted sustainable rural electrification in Latin America. There, I met some people that actually work with Amir Kohler until now, so that's a small world, isn't it, in places like Guatemala and southern Mexico. Even though the cost was very high even then, it made very, very good sense to demonstrate the use of solar and wind power for critical applications in the community like water pumping and refrigeration. A few of the larger communities chose to work with us to add renewables and storage to their diesel plants, which resulted, you know, back then in some of the earliest hybrid systems in operation successfully. These early efforts, some of them led by Sandia and other national laboratories, demonstrated the feasibility of drastically reducing diesel fuel consumption while keeping the lights on for longer hours. We also documented some of the key challenges that really made sustainability and replicability difficult. The first one was initial cost. It continues to be an issue today. Even though the benefits in the long run are greater, the initial cost is a huge barrier. Second is technology readiness. It was problematic at that time. Off-the-shelf electronic equipment, things like storage systems, degraded and sometimes failed faster than expected due to the very difficult operating conditions, high humidity, temperature swings, things like that. Possibly the most challenging issue was institutional and human factors, actually. That was an eye-opening lesson learned for me. These included things like the lack of business models, poor access to technical expertise and support, financing, all of these complicated but very difficult logistics in remote communities. I am sure that my colleagues here in Alaska will attest to the fact that these difficulties that we encountered so many years ago are still very relevant today. Significant progress is being made, however, here in Alaska, supported by entities like the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, working hand in hand with communities and utilities. Because the cost of remote energy, as Senator Cantwell said, is high in these communities, it makes good sense to consider new technologies that may not be economically viable in other places. A similar set of conditions is driving the adoption of microgrid and hybrid system technologies in places like Hawaii, DoD forward operating bases, and other remote mission critical installations. Here, I want to emphasize that remote microgrid developments are also paving the way for modern national grid advancements. Fundamentally, the same technologies that are used in remote microgrids are being deployed within the larger interconnected power system. In that context, those technologies are delivering cost savings for consumers. They're also delivering improved energy resilience for applications like transportation, communications, and so on. There is a lot to be done still. Microgrids can be more reliable, more affordable, more scalable. Advanced microgrids, as the mayor said, can help us integrate higher quantities of renewable energy and distributed energy resources, and can contribute to a secure and resilient national grid. To achieve this vision, there is a need to further develop and push forward the underlying technical or the underlying technologies such as energy storage and power electronics. We still have work to do there. Controllers, protection systems that are applicable in this setting. We also need better methods, models, and tools to support optimal design and operation of these systems. We also need those kinds of tools to guide investment and even policy decisions. Finally, more work is needed to shepherd the orderly evolution, and this is a big one, of technical standards that will allow microgrid components to interact safely and securely with each other, with utility systems, and with energy markets of the future. This work involves complex, as I said, technical, institutional, and even human factors. The Department of Energy and its national laboratories are playing a critical role in this space. It makes a lot of sense. This is a challenge of national importance. In closing, let me reiterate that advancing remote microgrid technologies for the benefit of Alaskans also has the potential to enable a more modern, secure, and resilient national grid. This committee is very aware of the impact that investments in energy technologies has had over time. One example that is often brought up is Sandia's advanced drilling technology, which has been cited by members of this committee in the past. In my opinion, microgrid research and development will have an even greater impact nationally. With that, I'll say thank you very much again for your attention, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Dr. Ellis. Ms. Holdman, welcome, Gwen.
Thank you. Thank you.
The only one that I know that came to the hearing today by sailboat.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Murkowski and Ranking Member Cantwell, for the opportunity to be here this morning. So I direct the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and we play this unique role. We're based at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, but we work really closely on one hand with our communities and utilities to make sure that the kinds of technologies that they're aware of, these kinds of next generational emerging technologies, and we're working with them to try to make sure that they're adapted in ways that are going to meet the kinds of goals of reducing energy costs and increasing reliance and resiliency of our small grids here. On the other hand, we're working with developers and industry to try to make sure that their technologies are developed in such a way that they're going to be appropriate and are going to be successful in these sorts of small grid environments. And we have a laboratory at the University of Alaska Fairbanks where we do a lot of testing of technology before we try to move it into the communities where it can be deployed and taken advantage of by our utilities and our residents. I really appreciate the fact that Senator Murkowski has done such an excellent job in advocating for Alaska's excellence in terms of microgrid technologies. I think it's been mentioned here several times that Alaska does have more microgrids than basically anywhere else in the world that have grid-scale renewables connected to them. And one of the things I want to highlight is that a lot of the expertise that Alaska has in terms of developing these sorts of systems really resides within our utility industry here in Alaska. And so I'm really happy to be here with both Clay Copeland and Mira Kohler, who are really two of the people that I think are really leaders in the way that our utilities are adapting creatively new technologies and new ideas and really looking for what the energy grid of the system is going to look like, what the systems of the future are going to look like. And so, I also appreciate that Senator Cantwell pointed out the fact that we're not just talking about these unique small situations in Alaska, but that this really does represent the way that we're going to transform the electric grid in the rest of this country in the future too, which will be around greater integration of renewables, more distributed generation, and just trying to form these microgrids that enable more resilient, reliable grid infrastructure across the country. And I think I do agree with you that Alaska is really that place where we're pioneering a lot of those technologies that will get us there. The world has been more and more recognizing that Alaska is doing some unique things here, that we're really pushing these levels of renewable energy generation, like Mira is, to levels that would make most utility operators pretty nervous. And they're doing that through these very, kind of innovative sorts of strategies, not just incorporating energy storage, but also demand response, looking at smart grid enabling technologies. There's a lot of things going on here that are quite interesting. We have the Arctic Remote Energy Networks Academy. We're bringing people from all over the Arctic together to do knowledge sharing about these sorts of microgrids. We're hoping to expand that to a more global level, but we have people coming from Greenland and Canada and Russia and other places in the Arctic region that can benefit from these sorts of solutions. They're coming to Fairbanks in 2 weeks, and then we're taking them to Kotzebue and on to Nome in that particular case. But those are examples of where Alaskans can share that expertise. I'm also really excited to talk about some positive examples for state and local and federal collaboration. In particular, the last time that you had a hearing in Bethel, I talked about the need for an Alaska hub for energy innovation and deployment, something that we were really hoping to work with the Department of Energy on. And I'm really excited to tell you that has moved forward, not with the Department of Energy, although we hope to bring them on as a partner in the future, but with the Office of Naval Research, who's invested in Alaska to develop an energy innovation ecosystem here that goes all the way from our STEM K through 12 education through the development of an Alaska Network for Energy Education and Employment through REAP, all the way through funding our energy accelerator here, or our small business accelerator, the Launch Alaska program, through testing and development of new energy systems at the university and then deploying those in the field. And so that's a program that we're actually spinning up within the next few months and we'll be working on for the next 3 years. That will give us the chance, for example, to be working with Mira on a particular system that she's identified as a need for her communities, which is the small amount of energy storage, a grid bridging system that will enable her to, in an economical way, integrate both more renewables or just save fuel by switching more efficiently between smaller and larger diesel generators, which are still going to be the backbone of generation in rural Alaska for some time to come. So that funding is allowing us to seek external partners to kind of find those sorts of solutions moving forward. My colleague here from Sandia National Lab, Dr. Ellis, also mentioned this project that we have through the Office of Electricity. And this is a great example from my perspective of state and local collaboration, because the Alaska Center for Energy and Power and Cordova Electric Cooperative, we identified this potential opportunity for energy storage here around a bit of a unique paradigm for how that would be integrated here. And we pulled in expertise through the Clean Energy States Alliance and requested expertise from specifically from San Diego National Laboratory. The Department of Energy responded to that request. The project is led by, and we are setting the context but locally here, but Sandia National Lab is providing critical expertise to make that project happen. And those are the kinds of ways that we want to be partnering with our national labs. I think it's a really great story. Similarly, we have a lot of regional partnerships going on. We work really closely with the University of Washington on the Northwest Marine Energy Research Center. So we have three universities there, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, UW, and then Oregon State University that work with Department of Energy on this regional collaboration around hydrokinetic technologies. And we appreciate both of your long-term support for ocean and river and in-stream energy solutions. I'm currently serving on the board of the University of Washington Clean Energy Institute. I'm the only person from another university that's serving in that role, and so that's another way that we're working really closely together. We have a program that we call the Center for Microgrid Technology Commercialization, and it's a partnership between the Economic Development Administration and the University of Alaska. And we actually host a competition for companies that have microgrid-enabling technologies to test their technology in our lab and work with our engineers with the idea of pushing it out into communities in Alaska. So we had our first round, our first competition that we just announced the winners for a few weeks ago. And actually UET, Uni Energy Technology, a battery manufacturer from your region, from Mukilteo, am I saying that correctly? Mukilteo is actually the winner of that particular award. And so we're going to be bringing their system up here to Alaska, testing it in our laboratory. And I actually hope that someday we might see that system the next time you come back, actually operating here in Cordova and providing that storage solution that we've been working on with Sandia to identify right now. So that's really that all I have to say. I apologize for going a little bit over, but this need for driving partnerships, I think, is really important, and I'm really excited to hear that you're still moving forward with this concept of an energy bill, because I think that we do need an update to, you know, to kind of create that framework at the national level, but really sort of promoting these partnerships and really pushing the understanding of what is needed to the lowest common denominator, where that's our communities and our states, so that we can be pulling in expertise from the federal government. That's the type of framework that we're excited to work around. So thank you.
Well said. Great, great examples of partnerships there. Mira, wonderful to have you here.
Thank you. I do appreciate the opportunity to be here. Both under your tutelage, you have really pioneered, I think, a support system for rural Alaska that is second to none. So welcome to Cordova, both the ranking member and to the chairman. I am going to take the privilege of saying that because Cordova was my home many years ago. It was where I immigrated. I come from India, and I came from New Delhi and literally moved here. So Cordova absorbed me, they embraced me, they made me a part of them, and so it'll always be home. Every time I come back here, my heart is just light with joy at being back here. But I have been in the electric utility industry since 1979, started out here in Cordova, and have been the CEO of three Alaskan utilities, a very small one in western Alaska at Naknek, and one of the largest ones in Alaska, which is Municipal Light and Power, which is the municipal utility serving Anchorage, and now AVAC. I've been at AVAC for 17 years. So my heart is very much in rural Alaska, and I have always felt that rural Alaska has something to offer the entire world, and we need to make it a pro quo situation. A little bit about AVAC. We are a co-op nonprofit formed in 1967. We now serve 58 communities. Our latest community that we added actually is about 200 miles southeast of here. We're in Yakutat now. So I now have 1,000 miles between my farthest west and my farthest east community, and 800 miles north to south. So it's a very vast area. These communities are very small. Average population is about 450 people. And the average load in one of these communities is essentially about half of a grocery store in Anchorage. So the Huffman cars that I shop at basically equates to two of my villages rolled together in terms of electricity usage. Despite the fact that Alaska is very energy rich, we have a lot of natural resources, we're actually a very energy poor state. We sell a total of about 6.3 billion kilowatt hours in Alaska, which is half, less than half of what Sacramento sells in California. That's one community sells twice as much as the entire state of Alaska. So that's a very stark difference. And what it tells you is that our retail energy is very expensive. In our villages, I'm very proud to say I got Clay beat. Our best rate is 24 cents a kilowatt hour in Bethel, and our highest is about 68 cents a kilowatt hour where we have to fly fuel in. But what's happening in these villages is that communities are being held hostage to very high cost energy, and it's not even the electricity that's so expensive, it's the heat and transportation. That's what eats their lunch, if you will. So we really are totally focused on solutions for our communities. So we do operate 50 microgrids, and we serve those 58 communities. What we have been trying to do is basically create the regional energy grid that Senator Cantwell mentioned earlier. We shut down power plants. We've shut down about 6 power plants in the last 10 years or so, and we are now serving those communities through interties. And actually, I have worked with Gwen on HVDC at a micro level to try and connect more villages. The cost of building capacity in rural Alaska is extremely high. It costs about $17,000 per service to establish utility service, which is 5 times what it is in the lower 48. So that puts into perspective what the costs are that we grapple with. But we have collaborated to set up some pretty unique microgrids. Gwen mentioned that we're able to do very high displacement in our villages. So we have a few communities where we are displacing almost 40% of the diesel used for generation with wind. And that's because we have highly intelligent dispatch that we've actually created ourselves. So we have on staff really some of the world's most ingenious minds, I think. And so I really welcome the national labs working with us to basically partner on solutions that are going to allow even higher penetrations of wind and of solar. I was at a breakfast meeting with Sam Mikowski and Jay Faison from ACCF, which was fascinating just a few weeks ago. And I'd actually just before that, a month before, had been in conversation with Oklo, which is developing the micronuclear project. And I think that those are going to be what turns Alaska around. I've always had this concept in my mind of the bubblegum machine with all these little bubblegum balls in it that contains a little nuclear fission material inside of it and creates clean, emission-free, long-lasting energy for very low cost. I'd like to see resources going into that concept. We're working with Gwen and ONR on microgrid optimization through the grid bridge system. We believe that truly is going to allow us to go diesels off in many of our communities. We have to understand that we can't be a test bed for emerging technologies. We have to have something that's more robust and that's street ready, because we can't afford to be in a situation where a community goes black because a nascent technology doesn't work. That's a life, health, and safety issue. If we have a multi-day power outage in one of our remote communities, you're going to have people that are facing life and death situations as a result of those outages. So we can't afford to have that happen. I just want to put a little plug in for the fact that you're hearing today about the urban utilities in Anchorage that are going to smart meters, and they're so proud of it. Well, hell, we've had those for more than 10 years. So every one of our villages, we have smart meters, and we have virtual SCADA, and we have the ability to do innovative things. So I really appreciate you coming here to listen to us in our home and understand how unique we are and how we really need your support to help us to move further along. I think we can go some wonderful places. So thank you again. I appreciate the opportunity to present to you.
Great, Mayor. Really appreciate that. Okay, Jeff, bring it home and explain how beer fits into energy. Jeff Larson.
And why doesn't he have a beer for each one of us?
That's what I thought. Mira, it's not noon.
It is somewhere.
Thank you, Senator Murkowski, Ranking Member Senator Cantwell. I am
I am intimidated by this panel. Because
so are we.
Because they represent communities, and they represent a broader out-of-self type of responsibility. And interestingly enough, beer has been one of the oldest industries in the world. There are hieroglyphics on the walls of the Egyptian tombs that describe the manufacturing process of making beer. And so when we started the brewery 31 years ago, I would have to say I felt fairly humble being in an industry that's had such a rich history. And but over the course of that period, I have become acutely aware that the beer we make is dominated by where we make it. And there are attributes of what we do that are influenced by our environment. And one of them is that we live in a tough spot. We have to do things differently because other people in other areas have industry norms. Oh, it's always done this way. Well, what we've discovered is that our attitude is a little bit different because we have to do things differently because it's not always done this way. And I'll give you a couple examples. And when we started, I don't think we really thought of ourselves as being grossly innovative. But the place creates the person. So one of the things that we do now, we call it beer-powered beer. We take a waste stream, which is our spent grain. When you make beer, you take grain, you steep it in hot water, you extract a lot of the good things that become the end product. But the residual, the waste, the spent grain, is something that others can easily deal with in areas where they're close to agricultural users, cattle feed and the like. But there are other facilities that have to dispose the grain in landfills because they're not close to the agricultural communities. For us, we knew that we didn't have much agriculture in Juneau, and so we very quickly realized we had to do things differently. So we started drying our spent grain, and we used a portion of it for fuel, but grain is a very difficult thing to burn. What we ended up doing is developing a process which we just received a patent for in regards to using spent grain as a sole fuel source for steam generation. Heineken Brewing Company tried to do this in Namibia, Africa, because they had a similar situation. There wasn't an agricultural user for their spent grain. It ends up that they had to abandon the project, and what they do is now use a combination of traditional fuels with their spent grain. Newcastle in Manchester, England, also did the same thing. They were in a municipal environment that they had to dispose of the spent grain. It was very difficult. They spent $25 million trying to develop a process using spent grain as fuel. They abandoned the project. We're the only brewery in the world that's using this waste stream as a fuel source for a steam boiler as the primary fuel. We're targeting about 60% of our fossil fuel replacement with spent grain. The commodities exchange price for spent grain is about $180 a ton, last I saw. At $2 a gallon of diesel, the value of that spent grain to us is $350 a ton. The value is kind of an indicator of what that means for breweries. The application of this technology actually is much more broad than just beer. 31 years ago, I'm just making beer. But creatively, I think we're going to be able to change the world. And I think the demonstrated examples that are being talked about here are just that same thing. The pioneers of yesteryear had challenges, and they made it work. Whether it be the railroad here in Cordova, the history of this town, or the White Pass Railroad. But it gives me goosebumps when I think about what we can transcend here from our locale. Now, obviously, Washington State has a number of innovators, and their impact in the world is obvious. But I also think that what we have, maybe with a disproportionate population, but a disproportionate geographic challenge, we think differently. This state thinks differently. And that application can be international in its impact. Mm-hmm. Carbon dioxide is another example that we innovated. Carbon dioxide is a gas that we use to press out tanks. We use it for blanketing, protecting the beer for its integrity. The most common source of carbon dioxide is fossil fuels. Lo and behold, when we're fermenting beer, a whole bunch of carbon dioxide comes off its fermentation. So in 1998, we started capturing all our CO2. In 1998, we were able to recover 800,000 pounds of CO2 from our fermentation. The fermentation gas is from photosynthesis. It's a renewable resource. Whereas most all other CO2s used by breweries is fossil-based. We replaced it. The steam generation that we're using right now for our plant, partially from our spent grain, also has to be downstepped in pressure. So not to get too geeky, but the pressure reduction process, we're using a steam cogen plant so that we're reducing the pressure by, at the same time, generating electricity. This is not in place. It's just being engineered at this moment. We have a zero power shift in our plant, so that we basically have the same phase coming in as going out. And it just gives me goosebumps to be able to be talking about things that are a little bit behind the scenes, because we're just making beer. You know, we're not saving lives. These people are saving lives. We're just making beer. But you know, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and be before this august panel. But I also think that what we have as an opportunity is as individuals and individual companies to make an effect that can be more broadly applied. And the type of platforms that we create are due to necessity. So while there may be accolades, I have to say that necessity is the mother of invention. And in that light, the opportunities that we are given here within the state, the opportunities that we see every day and enjoy, are one of the reasons why we're here, and we make it work. Thank you.
Great story. Really a great story. And I think it's important to add, you're not just some small local brewer. You've got the biggest distribution in the state and are distributing around the country now. So remarkable level of ingenuity that has allowed for an expansion to your business that is really quite incredible. So thank you for sharing that. You know, it does make me wonder, just as I listen to the panel here and the conversation coming back to how Alaskans are pioneering in so many different ways in different spaces. And I don't know whether it's because we have longer, darker winters and we just have more time to think. I think about this fleet of boats out here and those that spend a lot of time in a wheelhouse just kind of thinking, maybe we have time, more time here to just think about solutions to the daily problems that we have. But let me get to questions, not just musing, because you all have provoked such great thought here with all that you have brought forward. And I guess I'd challenge any one of you on the panel. Mayor, you spoke about the Aqua Harmonics and the great innovation there, the wave generator, and the recognition that those local folks have achieved, and the discussion also that you have raised, Mira, and it was great to be with you at that panel a couple of weeks ago about micro nuclear reactor advanced storage issues. Just kind of projecting out, where do you all see kind of this next generation of technologies that you think are particularly promising, either in the near term or the medium term, for solving some of the challenges that we are currently faced with when it comes to microgrid and hybrid energy solutions? And when you think about our coastline, when you think about the marine hydrokinetic potential that we have there, What are you looking at now as that next great opportunity? And again, keeping in mind that it might not take over the world, but it could transform a community here. What are you working on that's exciting that you can share? What?
I'll answer in two little pieces, and I'll jump kind of right to the end game of smart grids. So I envision a future where someone's washer and dryer set, for instance, a washer can hold a full year's supply of soap and fabric softener and everything. Once I throw the clothes in, I don't care when it runs, as long as it's in the next 24 hours. As I open my freezer and close it and take salmon in and out of it and everything, it can learn my habits with very inexpensive, robust sensor technology that's evolved so rapidly. It can learn my habits, and if it's talking to our electric system and knows when renewable energy is available, it can decide when it wants needs to cycle. And if it's talking to the system if our grid is also talking to all the other freezers in the system, it could say, well, let's run these freezers and then these in progression instead of all at once, and actually smartly manage people's appliances and uses in a fully integrated way that can almost kind of create demand from the user side. So that's where a lot of where the technology can go is electric vehicles. Right now we're working with ASAP again, and the U.S. Air Force has a grid-to-vehicle program that they're just kind of reaching the end of. And as I think of, you mentioned Senator Cantwell, Department of Defense, and how they're kind of also frontier installations and whatnot. Well, we have the Coast Guard here, and as you know, they're considering two fast class cutters in Cordova. But imagine an environment where they can not only provide their services here, but also engage with the Department of Defense through the Department of Defense in some of these new technologies, where these excess electric vehicles from the Air Force with their smart grid technology, our smart system can charge those one day or when we have some excess power, and then discharge them back onto our grid. So I see a future smart grid where we can use automation and sensor technology in this world-class technology that Schweitzer Engineering Labs, one of our partners in Washington, is really involved with. The second little piece would be, I lost my train of thought on, I was thinking the aquaharmonics, but one little piece that about 15 years ago I wrote a little white paper with Mead's Institute of the North on cryodams, and we have to ship tremendous amounts of steel and concrete in to build our hydroelectric plants, and yet we have glaciers that naturally dam some of our rivers and develop huge repositories of water. So why not do that intentionally? Why not use our local glacial silt and actually wood pulp? 100 years ago, during World War I, the British, or World War II, the British built a frozen aircraft carrier in Canada. It took it 3 years to thaw out when it was done. So particularly in Greenland, where they have some excess hydro in places, they can use that over transmission lines to freeze materials and use that as our dams of the future, maybe. And now that we have advanced micro technology, carbon fibers to reinforce them, sensor technology that you can literally blend in with the frozen material that can communicate the stresses and strains, we have a next layer of technology now that can maybe make something like that possible. We just need to find a way to test it, and through FERC on federal land would be tough, but that's why partners like Greenland, again, they have the necessity. They have ice, rock, and water, and very little else, so maybe that's a technology we can share with them.
One of the things that we saw yesterday that was very interesting at McKinster was it was basically just computer panels, and what we were looking at was all of the schools within a particular school district, and they could tell where you were losing energy, where there was inefficiency. And they just, you send a note off and somebody does something, and next thing you know, everything is, but when we think about our schools and the amount of money that we spend just to keep our schools heated and warm, so much so that it comes out of the academic side of the budget equation. We've got Senator Senator Stevens here with us, and he knows the impact to our schools when our energy costs are high. But just from the smart technologies that are out there, we can be doing so much more. Others, I'm over my time, but go ahead, Mira or Gwen or Dr. Ellis, go ahead.
Well, you know, we have demonstrated very high penetration renewables in our communities, but we can go a lot higher. We now have 15 communities served with wind, with the 11 wind farms. We've got two more large turbines going in, and one of them is going to be a pretty unique installation because it's a 900-kilowatt machine in the community of St. Mary's, which is a very small community. We do have the ability, and I'm going to be connecting them with another village, but you're still going to be at about 150% of peak capacity with that wind turbine. And so what we're working on with the grid bridge concept, I think, is going to get us a long way. But one of the technologies that I think is not being paid enough attention to is the potential to use hydrogen from, you know, water. Everybody's got water. Every village has water. Can we come up with a relatively low-cost hydrolysis program to create hydrogen to supercharge the diesel fuel that we are using? I mean, it's all about efficiencies. That's the reason we have wind, is to get the most kilowatt hours per gallon of diesel fuel. If we can use the surplus wind to create hydrogen to get even more efficiency out of that diesel, that, I think, is a relatively seamless technology. It's right now, it's not commercial, but maybe that's something that we could focus on as to how we can put some of that excess renewable energy to good use. And also the issue of connection. Alaska, as I said, is an energy-starved state. And what Gwen and I and a few others have partnered on, Rob, also, is the concept of HVDC, a large HVDC grid across the state of Alaska, which would allow us to put very large amounts of renewables in with very inexpensive natural gas from the North Slope and displace millions and millions of gallons of diesel across the state and to feed our energy-starved industry. We, as I said, Alaska sells 6 billion kilowatt hours a year, which is less than half of what Sacramento sells. That's just a crying shame. Our industry is starved. We can't attract good industry like server farms and other high-tech technologies over to Alaska because we don't have affordable energy. There is no substitute for affordable energy. So I think that there are opportunities for partnership and evolution that are second to none.
I'll just kind of follow up on what Mira is saying. I think right now, what Mira and other utility managers are doing in Alaska is really pretty incredible. I just want to highlight that one more time. You said 40% displacement of diesel fuel in some of your communities. But at an instantaneous penetration level, she's getting to 100% on a relatively regular basis. I don't know how many utility managers in other parts of the country would feel comfortable with 100% penetration of wind energy on their grid, right? This is just not something that's done anywhere else, I don't think, in the United States on a regular basis. And so right now, I think what we're really focused on is improving process efficiencies in a short term. How can we do better along the lines of what we're already doing? And that could be, like, for Clay, looking at how do you stop doing frequency regulation using your hydro so that you can maximize your hydro potential and use other ways of actually getting that frequency regulation where right now you're losing 10 or 20% of your potential production because of that. Or for Mira, with this grid bridge system, this is going to give her the chance to eke out a little bit more efficiency. And a lot of the utilities in Alaska are using this demand, basically having thermal loads and other loads in specific locations. Like, for example, in Kotzebue, they have an electric boiler in the hospital there. And that is turned on and off based on how much wind energy is being produced at any one time. And so the utility controls that. And so that's a way that we're really able to manage the energy production as a whole, not just looking at electric power, but also these heating loads. And there's days where they don't need to run their alternative diesel-fired boiler at all. They're just running on electric power. So looking at, like, distributed controls, we're working with ABB on that. They've been a big player up here in Alaska. I know you heard from Siemens the other day in your testimony, too. You know, getting these companies up here to partner with Alaskans is really important, and you can help advocate for that because we can work with them to harden their strategies. And I think that's something in the short term that we're thinking important. Electric vehicles is a piece of that. And then this, and then also this built environment question. You know, we've been doing a lot. Cold Climate Housing Research Center is not represented here today, but they have a Northern Shelters program, really making sure that our building systems are appropriate for the environment is important. Long-term, I agree with you, Mira, transmission, trying to figure out ways to reduce the cost of transmission using like multinodal HVDC. That's something we're quite interested in up here because that would be the strategy for building out a grid in larger parts of the state. Energy storage continues to be the holy grail. I don't think that we have the optimal solution for that yet. So that's something that I'd like to see the federal government continue to invest in. Hydrokinetics, ocean, wave, river energy. That's something that's really important up here in Alaska because if we can find effective, cost-effective ways to take advantage of our water resources, almost every community in Alaska is based on some sort of body of water. And then nuclear, you mentioned this small mini nuclear solutions and small nuclear battery that you can bring into these remote places. I really think that that's something that that we need to be looking at. I'm not always a proponent that Alaska needs to be a first adopter of these kinds of technologies, but long term, if we have really safe, reliable, small, mini nuclear reactors, that would be an excellent solution for many remote places in this state too.
Senator Cantwell, and I know we'll have an opportunity to just continue this kind of open dialogue.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. This is really fascinating. So many things I want to ask, so I'll try to get come up with a couple of broad things for all of you. But I think for Gwen and Dr. Ellis, you know, we've done so much demonstration, as the mayor was saying, you know, just on these big, you know, expensive, if you will, home usages. The Pacific Northwest Lab did a demonstration out on the Olympic Peninsula on dryer usage and other appliances and showed that you could get a double-digit savings. But it strikes me that here we are, we're going, you know, our national lab going out to one geographic region of our state trying to prove a theory. But to your point, Gwen, why wouldn't microgrids just be like the go-to people every day of the week? If you were either our national interest or a private interest, the microgrid is like the best beta test you could possibly ever have, and you could probably get it done in like a week. You could find out what's happening. So I know we have in our bill trying to promote some demonstration projects on the microgrid, but should we be being even more aggressive given how much information that we could learn by doing these small-scale deployments? We could just be getting so much information back so quickly.
Well, Senator Cantwell, I would like to just make the point that I really appreciate you recognizing that we have this unique opportunity to be testing and demonstrating things in Alaska. We actually don't like to think of it as being demonstration and pilot projects. We're beyond that. We just want to make this stuff work, not just over some short period of time where there's some funding, but we are looking down for the long haul and making these things work. And our utility managers are really very, very willing to be a strong partner in that. I think one thing that both of you are, I believe, aware of is that at the federal level, our Alaskan grids don't count as microgrids according to the federal definition by Department of Energy. And that's hindered us really significantly in terms of being part of these longer-term testing kinds of scenarios. A microgrid at the federal level for the Department of Energy is a small ice grid that can island and isolate itself, but it needs to be able to connect to a larger grid, or else it's considered a separate, you know, islanded grid. And so there's money put aside for looking at specific situations around islanded grid. But I really think that we need to be thinking of this as just a microgrid. And the fact that we're not connecting to a larger grid is really irrelevant because the difficult part is about the islanding part. And so when the Department of Energy, you know, calls us out as not counting, I think it really hinders our ability to be part of that national solution.
Dr. Ellis, should we be doing more demonstrations on microgrids?
In my opinion, absolutely. There are many, as I said in my opening remarks, interesting technical questions that haven't been answered in detail. Just give you a couple of examples. Some of the microgrid demonstrations that we do and work hand-in-hand with stakeholders in those have to do with high security applications, for example, where you know, we don't not only want reliable electricity from the point of view of electrons, you know, being delivered to the load, we also want to make sure that those energy systems are cyber secure. And so sometimes we don't think about these things, but for some applications, that's absolutely paramount. So we're trying to push the limits on what it means to have secure energy supply that is able to withstand physical and cyber threats in different applications. So we definitely some more of that. I also want to point out that this issue of trying to get to 100% renewables in practice is very hard. What has been talked about today is that some communities asymptotically kind of get there by putting in 10, 15, 20, 25%. By the time you get to the kind of penetration levels that we were talking about in some places here in Alaska, things become rather difficult. It's not a lot of fun to think that you're relying 100% on inverters and batteries and things that, you hope nothing bad happens. So we're looking at cases within these microgrids that might be a little bit extreme so that we can, in the future, guarantee that these systems really are robust. For example, when you're running on 100% solar or wind, some of the things that the engineers worry about is what happens when there is a fault on a line. With a typical power system that has rotating machines like a micro hydroelectric, the system is able to ride through that fairly well. But the dynamics, when you look at that in detail, are very different when you have 100% penetration of renewables. So it is really those cases that we are trying to iron out from a national laboratory perspective to make sure that these systems are bulletproof, so to say, at 100% penetration. And some states are going in that direction. I mean, you've seen, for example, the story of Hawaii. That's where they're going. There are other countries, including places like Ireland, that have similar goals and are at a very high penetration level. But as they go there, they find some of these technical problems that are challenging, down in the details. So we believe that more demonstrations that showcase how to solve those problems, those edge problems, are extremely valuable for the industry.
I think that's so important and shouldn't be lost about the advent of microgrids, that they have so much from a testbed perspective. Having been involved in the early days of internet media software, I can just tell you that, you sit around and talk about, well, how is this going to play out and how is that going to play out? And then all of a sudden you can just make it live and instantaneously get feedback from it, from thousands of people was a great asset, something that we weren't able to do before. So to me, the microgrid, whether you're talking about security or you're saying the technical problems of integration on renewables, we should be looking at ways in which we can just make sure there's applicable resources there to allow the microgrids to give us more information. Mm-hmm. I'm saying this broad scale deployment of a technology takes us so much time.
It does.
To get the feedback, and you can get us like instantaneous feedback. I'm not saying it's really a week, but I don't know. Actually, you might be able to, and not to destabilize them, but to allow them to give us some real-time information. I also think as we start this era, which I guarantee you is going to end up being one of the most tumultuous eras of what a utility is today, okay, there is going to be a transformation of how energy is basically developed and put onto the grid and delivered back to the home. I mean, I'm pretty sure in 20 years, 25 years, we're all going to be in the energy business. I mean, that is our home is going to be in the energy business, and it's going to be generating something and it's going to be putting it back onto the grid. Or we right now in Washington probably have the highest electric vehicle deployment. That is because of our cheap kilowatt rate and the interest of the public. So we will end up trying to think of that battery storage in our communities and whether it's smart enough to give put that into our car at night and then the next day sell it back onto the grid at the cheapest kilowatt rate. Those kinds of things, are going to transform, in the next couple decades, how utilities are perceived and how they work and you are the tip of the spear of that. In reality, you are the tip of the spear because you are doing that right now. The microgrids are doing that right now. The microgrids are thinking about these relationships between what is a utility and what is the consumer and what are they developing and what are they putting onto the grid and how are you going to get it? Anyway, so you could play a very valuable role for our country that way. So I appreciate that. And Mr. Larson, I don't know that you're claiming the title renewable beer, but you're getting pretty close.
Well, I actually have some oblique comments in regards to that. You know, Juneau's an amazing community. Alaska's an amazing state. In 1916, February 14th, the first lake tap in North America was put online. And that was a high alpine lake tapping the anaerobic area of the lake where basically no adverse effects were being implemented in the environment, mm-hmm. powering basically because of necessity those pioneers that wanted power for the mines. Well, that lake tap, Annex Creek, is still supplying, I think, about 10% of Juneau's power 101 years later. Juneau is 99.9% hydro. However, hydro is blanketed as not a new renewable resource because of the impacts having to do with dams and the like in other areas, which has tainted this truly green power source. And I think start thinking about other types of issues. That's something that really needs to be addressed. I think the fact that we are 100% green electricity, renewable resource, needs to be recognized, but it's not on a federal level.
Well, I can tell you that BMW builds a car or parts of a car in our state, the i3, because they market that car as a totally renewable car. Every aspect of that car can be renewed, and the electricity that produces it comes from hydro, so they call it, they were producing it there so they can make that claim to consumers. And we're going to see more of this as, mm-hmm. you know, consumer interest shifts that way. But you're saying that you had a 60% fuel
reduction. For steam generation. So what we end up doing, we use electricity for much of our refrigeration, but we also, in the process of making beer, you're boiling the precursor to essentially remove all the good stuff from the hops that we get from Yakima. And but in that we need fossil fuel use. So that's where we're like replacing 60% of our fossil fuel use. But the interesting thing that Mayor Copeland brought up is one of our electrical uses is refrigeration. Now our refrigeration needs aren't like on a demand issue. We can delay certain types of refrigeration initiations based upon the peak loads of the utilities. And I think that's the other point I was going to maybe mention. And again, these are very sophisticated regulatorily controlled processes, but there's ways for industry to partner with a local utility. But because of the bureaucratic time and effort, there's just no way. I mean, it's regulated, understandably, for good reasons. But I look at the fact that our utility, their hydro, I mean, they have interruptible power sources. And historically, the way they used to do it is they would partner with industry and allow industry to bear the burden of the exposure and risk and cost, because they were on diesel. For example, our Kensington mine, which is a very large mine outside of Juneau, is on interruptible power. So during those periods of time when the hydro reservoir is being depleted to the point where maybe they will have to sit there and go to a diesel backup, they have certain interruptible users. Greens Creek mine is one of them. So they will go offline. They have to go on diesel. Now that's an on-off situation. And, you know, quite frankly, a very large user, it makes sense to go through the bureaucratic labyrinth to be able to get that done and have it approved by the regulatory agencies. But in a situation like ours, where there's a peak load in our community on specific diurnal cycles that are well known by the utility, we could have our refrigeration delayed by 2 hours, 3 hours. So there isn't that flexibility within that regulatory compliance for us to be able to partner. So when you're talking about the dryers, guess what? We have a 1 megawatt service. Mm-hmm. And that peak issue that they face, they fear our spikes. We're right now controlling our refrigeration. We're basically able to sit there and start to reduce our peak demands because of the fact that we have higher sophistication in monitoring our systems. But we're doing it independently. if we partnered with our utility and could do that economically, we could reduce significantly our impacts on the utility. You gang that up, and we're basically doing exactly what's being proposed here.
So flexibility, a little flexibility as well.
Yeah.
So we'll look at that. And then do I understand, so you patented some of this technology mm-hmm. that's being deployed across the industry sector now?
Yeah, and the thing is that it sounds like, no, there's no question, it's situational. So certain breweries that are within maybe a very large metropolis and they cannot take their spent grain out to the agricultural users, they have a problem. And so there are breweries that are landfilling their spent grain. And even though that was an option for us, theoretically, it wasn't an option for us, ethically. So I think, we put all our efforts. And I'll tell you what, they talk about the cutting edge of technology. I call it the bleeding edge of technology. Because it's extraordinarily painful. It's extraordinarily expensive. But where there's a will, there's a way. And, you just put it down. And while we sit there and sometimes look at life cycle costing, and I remember the first 5 years of operations, if that piece of equipment didn't pay for itself in 1 year, we weren't going to do it. And so then it's changed. Now, you get loans for 5 to 7 years, commercial loans. And so if that pays for itself in 5 to 7 years, okay, that's a viable approach. Well, some of this is the paybacks are much, much, much longer. But situationally, it could be a non-starter for a brewery in some remote location or some, downtown municipality like in Manchester, England. But it's not just brewery technology. There's a lot of types of materials that are very difficult to burn. Mycelia from the pharmaceutical industry, it's a biohazard, and they have a very difficult time. It has a very strong problem in its combustion. They try to incinerate it, and they have to use a lot of fossil fuels to do it. Well, our technology is applicable to it. And that's just one of dozens of different types of things. But I go back to, I'm inspired by the history of our pioneers, and I look back in 1916. What in the world were they thinking? They sat there and tunneled under this high alpine lake and tapped it, and then Senechan came on in the 60s, and then Lake Dorothy, Juneau is hydro. And they've also taken that innovation and applied it to interruptible power users. They do that on a community basis for those people who have electrical heat in their homes. They have programs where they can interrupt their heat use. I just think it would be great to have it even more broadly based so that we can all work together as a community. The Seal Classic, reduce your needs. This is one way we can reduce our needs, and that is a cheap, cheap, cheap way.
Yes. Yes, it is. Thank you. Madam Chair, I have more questions.
Oh, I know. We've got tons of questions, and I'm sure that everybody sitting here would love to jump in. You mentioned a little bit, Jeff, on the investment side. We talk a lot back in Washington, D.C. about this valley of death, where you have the innovation that is going on in our national labs, in our universities, in entities like ASAP here. And then you have the problem of getting to commercialization and actually seeing that translate into viable activity and action. And I know that there's probably a few people here in the audience that are actually interested in the investment end of things. As a state right now, our Alaska Renewable Energy Fund, as I believe, has no money in it. Mm-hmm. We've had opportunities through the state and various programs to help facilitate some of the investments. At the federal level, there are obviously grant opportunities to help build things out, but so much of what we see that is lost between the good idea and getting it into play so that there is benefit shared is kind of in this valley where it is just not enough to allow for the public-private partnership to move forward so that you've got this level of investment. And I appreciate what you said, Mara. You know, while we need to have a level of testing and you know, Alaska can be this great incubator for good ideas, but we can't be a test bed just for the purpose of being a test bed, because we need to have these applications street ready, because if they're not, you have communities that are in the dark and in the cold. So how do we do a better job, again, with the partnerships that must take place at a time when the state is facing financial issues? From the federal perspective, we've got some real serious budget constraints that will be upon us as we're moving forward in this next budget for 2018. How can we be most helpful at the federal level then to help move good ideas from the incubator to commercialization in a way, in a manner that's going to be helpful? And Jeff, you know, you kind of speak about the history over 30 years of what you were able to do. You have to have your investors that believe in where we are with this. How are we making it happen in Alaska? What can we be doing better at the federal level to help facilitate that? And whether it's specific programs that we should be looking at, give us that information. But help me out here in terms of how we make sure that the good ideas that we talk about now don't get lost in this so-called valley of death.
And I'll just touch on it real quickly. All too often, we have federal agencies like DOE and others that basically helicopter in, and they tell us what wonderful things they're going to do for us and how they're going to transform our world, and then they leave. And
they need to be listening to you.
they do. We need to be involved. They need to involve us in coming up with solutions. I think that Sandia's presence here is wonderful. I believe the national labs can be major players. I think ONR has just been a fabulously receptive resource. But we do also have, for example, the Denali Commission and the High Energy Cost Grant Program and others like that, that have fostered innovation. And those need to be continued.
Great.
I'll kind of jump in from where Mira started there. I think one of the things that I believe that we can look at how we're using existing federal resources and kind of use them a little bit more wisely. Like Mira was saying, that a lot of times we have folks from the federal government, from labs that are kind of helicoptering in, I'll use her words, and providing technical assistance to our communities. But it's like what Clay was mentioning with NREL, that pointed out that here the EAC tribe, it was really more of like they could demonstrate best practices in some ways. And I think enabling Alaskans to really be providing that technical assistance for our communities that are struggling a little bit more makes a lot of sense, rather than having federal resources providing that technical assistance. And then where we really need technical assistance is to the kind of the higher functioning, you know, people that are looking at those next generation kind of things like ASAP. I would love to have folks from Sandia come and embed with ASAP and work with us and our utilities on like specific solutions. That would be one. That would be such a wonderful use of federal resources that we can learn from one another, and that we're really benefiting from working together on these solutions, rather than having labs that are just going into communities and providing technical assistance in ways that they don't understand the complexities of what's happening in Alaska. And it winds up being that people like me and Mira and Clay wind up running interference a lot of times with some of the things that are then proposed or suggested. I think also earlier involvement, and since we're talking specifically about innovation here, what I have really found, I've been really involved in this and thought about it a lot, been involved at numerous levels, and we need practitioners involved in an earlier level in the technology development process. I think that's really important. If you have folks like Mira that understand how things work at the end of the day, working more closely with the companies that are at an early stage of technology development, you're going to have a much better outcome in the end. And what we're seeing, and we have this laboratory, and we test the things that the utility is looking for. We have a full power fault simulator, so we can simulate. We can actually not even simulate. We can just do faults at full power levels to make sure that we can see how the equipment responds. But a lot of those guys that come in with these new technologies, they've never thought about how to actually integrate their technology into the system. They have not put any thought into it. They just figure that's going to happen at the end of the day, no problem. But actually, if they'd thought about it at an earlier point, it would have saved a lot of hiccups along the way. So getting us Alaskans more involved early on in the technology development chain, because it's not just one valley of death, it's like multiple valleys of death that I think happen, you know. We've got to get practitioners involved at an earlier level to make better decisions as that's going along, and have immediate partners that you can have engaged, you know, as you're kind of trying to mature the technology.
And there's real quickly, one of the challenges that we run into is federal officials through various different departments coming in and trying to do direct interaction with communities, where you basically wind up being in competition with a utility that's struggling to provide the type of affordable service that they demand, and then you wind up with cross purposes a lot. So that needs to be taken a look at. Sorry.
Great. No, I appreciate that. Dr. Ellis.
I just wanted to briefly, I agree, first of all, with the sentiment so far on this area. Coming from a national laboratory, you know, my perspective is that we could do better in terms of information sharing among the national laboratories, among the institutions that work in this area. I think that promoting an easier way to share information through some sort of a consortium in this area would be really, really good. There is also something that we could do, I believe, a little bit better from the standpoint of national laboratories, to make it easier to partner with the private sector, with companies that are developing, as you call it, technologies that are in the early stage. We are there to serve the country, the nation. But the way that the national laboratories work sometimes make it a little bit difficult, I think, for particular smaller companies to partner with us. So we could use a little bit of help, you know, maybe reviewing how those processes or what are the available options for national laboratories to really support the kind of entrepreneurship, like, for example, the MHK folks that develop some of those MHK technologies here. I'd also like to say that we need to think of some of these challenges in the long term. I don't like this idea of parachuting into communities and saying that you're going to save somebody or whatever and then disappear. Some of these things actually take time, take a concerted effort over time. And I think that thinking about programs that are long-term, stable, and that have goals that need to be pursued hand-in-hand with the local stakeholders is something that we could potentially do better, to define those kinds of longer-term efforts. And we do that, I think, very well for science and technology development, you know, things like, coatings and biofuels and things like that. But when it comes to systems integration, it just seems like the pace of those partnerships are such that they're volatile. You know, one-year projects, and then it's gone. And so I would love to see more of these sort of longer-term projects that have us working hand-in-hand with communities.
Yeah, integration is the key. Jeff, Clay?
Go ahead, Jeff.
Okay. This is... innovation is back to the bleeding edge of technology. Innovation is very painful, and small purveyors have different ideas, and then they can implement them. I think if there's a way that some of their risk on a financial basis that could be defrayed, it'd be great. I'll give an example that we have. We put in a mash filter press, which is kind of a unique technology. No craft brewery in the U.S. used it. And what it is, it's almost it's a press that actually uses much less water in the manufacturing of that precursor to beer wort. But the press itself ends up yielding a very dry cake at the end of it. We end up using 6% less malt to get the same amount of beer. And we use, the first year we reduced our water usage by 2 million gallons of water. We're one of the lowest water users per gallon of beer in the United States. In fact, we were cited as best practices. A brewery to use as a resource to reduce your water usage. But how does this affect energy? Well, our lack of discharge of that 5% of the sugars because of the way we processed does not go down the drain. That less water does not go to our utility. The power savings, not only internally, because we use less water, we have to heat less water up, the power savings of our utility was strategically motivating for us to put this piece of equipment in. We were the first one in the United States to put one in for the craft sector. Now there are over 24 small breweries that are using the same technology. Sometimes you have to risk it. Well, we risked it for a lot of reasons. We're in a small community. Our impacts on our utilities is strategically important. Without the water, we ain't making beer. And without the wastewater treatment, we're not making beer. So it's a collaborative effort in reality and ethically. So if there's a way to be able to incentivize that sort of risk in technology, it can be magnified in its result. We proved to others we can make internationally award-winning beers. They didn't fear putting in a mash filter press. And now there are dozens of small craft breweries that are doing it.
You know, Lewis and Clark, before they headed west, were classically trained for almost 10 years in everything, biology. They were Renaissance men, you know, by choice. They needed to know, have all the tools. They were doctors, had the best medical technology. Literally, they became experts at just about everything they could. But they took Indian guides with them, starting from the East Coast all the way back. And that's how they crossed the Valley of Death and the rivers and the mountains and the terrain and the poisons and the unknowns. And that's how they got to their destination, and it saved their lives several times. Having a cultural guide who understood the cultures, even though they weren't maybe directly related to those Indian cultures as they crossed all the way west into Washington. And it's amazing to me that some of the most amazing innovators and technologists right here in our state 400, 500, 600 years ago and back for thousands of years lived on the Arctic slope. And think of the resource limitations there and have a sustainable society. In many ways, we need to get back to the future and figure out what are recapture some of those processes and whatnot. And I know you wanted to have a Native representative panelist today that got a little tangled up, but so I want to speak for them a little bit because they're one of our strongest partners. But we can be those tour guides for the national labs. They've got that world-class technology and all the best state-of-the-art equipment, but we can bridge that cultural gap and the real need on the ground and help things happen. And we're just so used to trying stuff. I laugh at Mira's hydrogen example because I literally took mason jar with distilled water and baking soda and ran a heat loop or ran an electric loop off the ignition of my car and made a hydrogen generator that we were plumbing into the air intake on our vehicles because we wanted to try it on our trucks first. And we ran it for several months and looked at our mileage and everything. We had a 15% gain and we were all excited until we realized the oxygen sensor was automatically compensating and burning more fuel to try to make up for it. We thought, why are we getting 15% gain? And it turns out we were just driving more carefully and accelerating. So, but that's how innovation happens, right? We learned a way to save 15% without the hydrogen thing. That's even better. So, and that's what we really want to do. And our investors are our members. It's the Greggs and the reluctant fishermen that pays those huge electric bills. We have to give a return on investment. And a lot of that happens by better utilizing the resources we already have, getting more out of our hydro projects. You know, we spill more hydroelectricity probably some years than we use in diesel fuel. So that's why these storage things, it's survival to us. It isn't just a laboratory concept. So if we can get together early on in these processes and work with the labs, like Glenn was suggesting, the whole journey gets much more efficient and the destination ends up being a lot more productive.
Well said. I always say that Alaskans have a PhD in living. And don't ever underestimate what it is that we are able to learn and then to share as we facilitate innovation. We're going to try to wrap this hearing by noon. So, Senator Cantwell, why don't you take the last 10 minutes for your series of questions here?
Okay. Well, I wanted to, thank you, Madam Chair, and I again, so appreciate the panel. I wanted to ask Gwen about this cold climate research, you know, kind of tying in a little bit of yesterday and a little bit of today. Mm-hmm. Where are we with you know, building and building materials and the science and integration and entering that to helping us with savings in the grid.
Mm-hmm.
And what else do we need to do to help be supportive from a federal perspective in the research of the Alaska Hub?
Right. Yeah, I think you know, each region, you know, we all have many different kinds of climate in the United States and different regions, you know, from pretty tropical hot areas to very, very cold areas in the Arctic. And so I think the issue around really locally appropriate housing that is going to both take advantage of the kinds of energy needs locally, whether that's cooling or heating, in addition to sort of the way that people use their home structures, like the way people in our communities, they really use their homes as part of like the, it's a social, it's an important social sort of aspect to it. So having small rooms and small spaces doesn't always work as appropriate for supporting the culture in our communities. And so really coming up with strategies, and this Northern Shelter Program that the Cold Climate Housing Research Center has developed, it's a nonprofit. That's a private nonprofit, and we work with them really closely because we're more on the grid scale, community scale. They're doing the built environment. And so making sure that we're looking at that really holistically and thinking across that entire spectrum, I think, is really important. And that's places where what they're doing is really critical. But as the state has less resources, those are programs that are really in danger of really losing steam, you know, and how can we really try to find more federal partnerships to try to shore up some of these really significant areas of expertise that have been developed. You know, our mayor in Fairbanks, where the Cold Climate Housing Research Center and the Alaska Center for Energy and Power are housed, has a net zero home in a very cold climate that's completely off-grid. Not because he wants to be off-grid, but because there is no grid where his house is, where our mayor's home is. And so, you know, Fairbanks is sort of this hotbed for research and innovation in a way that's sort of, you know, partnering across the state. But we really need to kind of keep in mind that housing component to it. I think it's really important to be thinking about things like insulation and weatherization. So,
well, one of the reasons the legislation that Senator Markowski and I have supported is we think Next Step is because it's really targeting on smart buildings. So 40% of our energy use is in buildings, and these facilities are, I equate it to the next phase of efficiency, given that fuel efficiency in automobiles drove the last chapter over the last 10 to 15 years. This next chapter is about getting that efficiency out of the building side so that we're reducing that 40%. So what else do we need to do to help, since we're not really a federal partner right now on the hub? What else do we need to do to help look at those solutions that are being deployed here?
Yeah. I think a lot of the things that have been, that you are already paying attention to, I think both of you are doing an excellent job and are very well versed on where we need to be going and really kind of putting together this framework or this roadmap. I think the important thing is to kind of pull Alaska into these solutions, because these things like demand response, demand, all the buzzwords that we, you know, are talking about at the national level, a lot of these things are already being done. The utilities figured out how to sort this out with customers. We have such small utilities here. How many utilities, like 140 in Alaska or some crazy number that Mira was quoting the other day? You know, they're very willing to push the envelope and come up with new strategies. So getting Alaska to be part of that is important. We are microgrids in this state. This is what we're doing here, and it's relevant to this national picture. You know, we've done a lot.
Mr. Jones, do you have a comment on that?
Just a quick comment here. This, we have been talking today about the issues surrounding energy. For us at Sandia Labs, the Arctic also represents a whole lot of other challenges. There is a lot going on in terms of a changing climate in the north here, where it's affecting communities. It is a question of national security in other cases. And, you know, energy is part of a much larger set of issues that we have to deal with here. I wanted to point that out because, you know, we have been, Sandia has been working in this area for a very long time in terms of climate modeling, doing measurements, tracking things like ice movements and things like that, and it is an important aspect of what we do. And I think it's really in terms of what can be done from a federal standpoint to see some of these opportunities flourish. I would challenge I think all of us, to find ways to connect some of these initiatives. I know that the Department of Defense, for example, has a high interest in the region as well. You know, I heard from Gwen and others that they're actually funding some of the work in energy you're doing here in the state. And I think that perhaps there are more synergies than we can see, or that, you know, that have come to the surface that we need to explore. Let me take one second only I meant to earlier make a comment about your question about whether or not the definition of microgrids really covers remote communities. So that's an issue that the DOE program manager has discussed before with his team of laboratories that are working. You know, I think as a laboratory team, we're all of the opinion that, you know, that definition isn't really meant to exclude remote communities. In fact, some of the projects that are being funded through the Smart Grid R&D program are specifically targeting remote communities. For example, the island of St. Paul here in the Aleutians has one of seven major projects to try to understand what we can do from the standpoint of better controls, you know, better ways of managing, you know, microgrids that are isolated with a lot of renewable resources. That's one of those projects. We're also working on new design methodologies and tools for off-grid microgrids, both, by the way, AC and DC microgrids, and those are also targeted remote communities. Just wanted to make it clear, can we do more? Absolutely. But we're all in a sort of a constraint resource sort of a situation. I'm actually leaving here energized with the opportunities to, not just from a technical standpoint, that are here in Alaska, but, you know, understanding that people here really want to, out of necessity and otherwise, make a difference. I think this is a great place to move things forward.
Thank you. And I know we're out of time, Madam Chair, but I just wanted to respond to the mayor. When Lewis and Clark got out to the mouth of the Columbia River, they literally got basically waylaid up into the side of the wall because of the treacherous nature of the mouth of the river. In fact, there's a place there commemorating it called Dismal Niche, which kind of gives you an idea of how dismal it was. They were without food and without a proper canoe to meet those headwaters. And the local tribe showed up to show them where to get food and to how to build a more sturdy canoe. The reason I'm telling this story is because in Clark's journal, he writes that nowhere, anywhere in America, did he ever see a tribe so influenced by the women than he had when he came to the Pacific Northwest. So I think, Senator Murkowski, it's in our DNA that this region of the world likes to be represented in the collaborative fashion that women bring to the table, and I thank everybody here for their participation in today's forum, and we'll take these ideas back and try to work in a collaborative fashion, both for the very front end of the innovation and the very applicable end of the innovation that's here in Alaska. So thank you for your great contribution.
Well, Senator Cantwell, I would like to thank you. I do have to say that as I listened to each of our witnesses this morning, I can't help but just feel so proud as an Alaskan. I do think that we recognize that we have a great deal to offer, but it's not just talking about it on paper. We're living it, we're doing it, we're making it happen, and we are capturing the attention of the rest of the country and the rest of the world. And so for those that have been dogged in their efforts, decades, to build a business where you're just making beer, but what you're doing as you're making beer is you are allowing others to believe in some things that many had just said were not possible. And I think we recognize that for Alaska's future going forward, we have to continue the level of innovation. We have to develop a level of resilience and almost autonomy, if you will, within our own communities. But I think that clearly brings about a level of challenge that stretches the mind and allows us to not only make good things happen within our communities, but then how we share that with the rest of the country, how we share it with the world. I firmly believe that so much of what we see happening here in the energy space can be replicated around the globe, because we are allowing that innovation to be brought down to a smaller scale, that there is room to move up, and we're demonstrating it here on the ground with great minds and great people, leading to great innovation. It's not very often that during a committee hearing I actually present a gift, but you are a guest in our community. I know the mayor has a jar of salmon there that I will allow him to present, but I wanted to make sure that you didn't leave town without a gift from Copper River Fleece. That when you come to Cordova, you must leave adorned with some aspect of something from Copper River Fleece. So from those of us here, we thank you for your contribution on energy, but thank you for being here to learn from some great Alaskans about our opportunities. And Mayor, since it is your town, I will allow you the final word, if you will.
Well, thank you, Senators, for your leadership and what you're doing for energy and energy policy in this country, and holding these kind of hearings and reaching out and helping us bridge that gap as communities, as a state, as a region of the Pacific Northwest, and as a country, and ultimately as the world. We do have a lot to share. And just Gwen and I were talking last night about, you know, deploying smart grid, and you know, we've both worked lightly with some Australian communities that are way ahead of us, and we're thinking we need to do that. We need to go there and work with them. That would be really tragic. We have those technical resources here. We would much rather be working with our own technical labs. There's so many connections here. Avista now, the electric utility for Juneau, was my path to call my friend Tim McLeod that manages that utility and say, hey, they're looking at this great, you know, battery opportunity down in Avista that I'd really like to, you know, or down in Pullman, Washington, that I'd like to look at it. And it's right there at Schweitzer Engineering Labs that makes the relays that we keep the lights on all the time with. So there's all these little connections that, and I think that's part of what we do, too, is we communicate well. So let's keep the conversation going. Thank you.
Senator Cantwell, the last thing I'm going to leave you with is a pullout from the Alaska Dispatch from last week, and the article is What Alaska Can Teach the World About Renewable Energy. So making it happen here every day. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for your contribution, and for those who have stayed throughout the morning, we greatly appreciate it, and the committee stands adjourned. 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 He stands adjourned. He stands adjourned. He stands adjourned. He stands adjourned.